Again, have you never seen how an idea win continue for ages to influence mankind, though all who knew its origin have passed away? Have you never seen how such an idea, though forgotten in its original home, will yet reappear somewhere else without any known connection having taken place? H. J. L. Then, once created, a thought may go on creating fresh thoughts? He. Yes, but only such as relate to it. It could not create a fresh thought on an entirely different subject. H. J. L. But a man can. Why, then, is it different? He may at one time create a cruel thought which will go on influencing others to do cruel deeds, yet at the next moment he may create a thought of kindness which others will develop into much that is good. Why this difference? He. Of what does a man consist? H. J. L. Matter, form, force. He. Of what does a thought, once created, consist? H. J. L. I suppose form only. He. You are answered. H. J. L. Ah, then it is the presence of what you call force. What is force? He. Some say force is God, and some that force and matter are God, and some that force and matter are the same, and it is this that is God. Can man create either? H. J. L. I suppose he creates only forms. He. Are you not, then, answered? H. J. L. I don't see quite how it answers my original question, namely, why we can create variant thoughts when our own thoughts cannot. He. God creates you, you create your thought influences others. Your thought's action is bounded by the thought that created it, your actions are bounded by the force which actuates you. God is bounded by nothing. H. J. L. I see it all. I cannot think about that of which I have no knowledge. But God is knowledge. He. God is all in all. You have learnt your first lessons. Now go for recreation, all of you. Next moment we were outside like boys running out from school, and we amused ourselves in many various ways. But our pleasures here are mental. What was our work on earth is our amusement here. I very naturally drifted into the set who were interested in architecture. They varied in size, or, really, in spiritual development. Many were in the upper forms of the school, and one of these suggested we should go off to see some of the famous buildings which had at one time existed. I don't want to see any of the hideous villas which disfigure most of our suburbs, I remarked. Such as one of those you built, eh? Remarked a boy whom I recognized as a man I knew slightly on earth. I should have felt annoyed on earth, but here I only chuckled. The big boy who had suggested the expedition answered, "Oh, you need not fear that. All that is hideous goes to hell. We don't get the finest work here, of course, that goes to the people in the sets above us. Still, all our stuff is good. There are some very fine Assyrian buildings we might go and see." "Do all the buildings come here, or only those which have perished?" I asked. "If a building is practically untouched it does not come here, but if it is partly destroyed and rebuilt, the whole of the original form comes here. You see, the alterations have given it a new form which may, in due course also come here. That's part of the interest of it. You can see how the Tower of London has changed from century to century. Of course we don't have its exact present form. So we went off to see the Assyrian buildings, and I enjoyed it immensely." J. W. As you are in with architects, do you ever come across a man called A? H. J. L. It's funny you should inquire about him, for he was the man who made that remark about the houses. J. W. About those you built? H. J. L. Yes. J. W. How is he getting on? H. J. L. He's an asset. He told me he was fearfully annoyed when he found he was with those who only half believed. He said to his teacher, "But I did believe." His guide replied, "Had you really believed, you would not be here. Like many others, you thought you believed, but belief does not consist of merely saying I believe. You must truly grasp it. Had you really believed, you could not have lived the life you did. plenty or people who thought they believed find themselves in hell. A man's belief must be shown forth in his life, or it is not real. This does not mean that a man who believes may not commit many grievous sins. He may. Nor yet does it mean that he will not suffer for them. We are responsible for every thought and act, but still, belief must be real before it counts. There is no deceiving anyone, not even one's own self, here. You half believed, and are, therefore, in this part. Had you not believed at all, you would be in hell. Now go and make progress. J.W. Is he? H.J.L. Not very fast. You see, he was younger, and almost all his interests were physical sports, good wine, women, and business. He died in the midst of them, and the earth pull is very strong. He is not earthbound, no one here is, but still he does hanker after the earth. Why, he often plays truant and goes back to his old haunts and friends on earth. It's not with the same desires as the earthbound go, hoping to be able to enjoy their old lusts, but with a kind of affection for old friends and places. I am really very sorry, for it throws him back terribly, and he's a very nice fellow. However, as he himself says, he died 30 years at least before his time, and I suppose he's got to spend that time before he'll be in the same position as those who died after their 78th birthday. He told that to the master one day when he reprimanded him for playing truant. He's fearfully slow in class, can't grasp quite simple things, although he died so much earlier than I did, I've passed him already. But he's a jolly fellow, very popular out of school. He misses his games, though, terribly. He's got a vein of humor. He explained the other day that he prayed fervently that his wife might not die for many years, as he was afraid she would rout him out here. Now you have heard quite enough, or you'll want to stick here altogether. We then began to walk back towards the avenue. Reaching there, we sat down, and I seemed to fall asleep. J. W. Chapter 11, He Attends His Own Funeral. Ninth Letter of H. J. L. At home, Glen House, February 21st, 7 p.m. After I had apparently been attending the school for a long time, my guide Carney to me one day and said, "It is time for you to go to your funeral." "My funeral?" I cried. "I thought that had taken place ages ago." "Oh no," he replied, "you have, according to our reckoning, been here quite a long time, but, according to Earth time, you have only been here 3 days." This was the first time I realized the huge difference between our method of reckoning time, or rather, our escape from time, and your subservience to it. In those 3 earthly days I had made apparently many months' progress, had learned much about spiritual things, and had seen numerous fine buildings of ancient days. At this point I should add that here there is nothing comparable to night and day, nor is there any sleep. This is, of course, evident if you think for a moment, for the spirit never sleeps even upon earth. It, unlike the body, needs no rest. Well, my guide told my master where I was going, and I was excused lessons. We were just going to begin work. I expect this sounds rather funny to you. Next moment we were at LD. There was no long journey through the ether, as I imagined would be the case. Simply I found myself in my old bedroom. Of course it is now plainer to me. Our world and yours are not separated by anything akin to space. One might almost say they are both in the same space. But there, it is impossible to make this point quite plain to you, I fear. I, of course, noticed that the room was changed and the furniture out of its proper place, and then I noticed the coffin. It was covered by a large white sheet, but I could see through this, and perceived my body lying there. Strangely enough, it did not seem to have the attraction for me which I expected it would. I looked at it more as one might look at a marble sculpture than as at an old friend. "You have finished your work and your day is done, old friend," I murmured. Even as I thought this, another thought welled up. Were you really a friend or only a taskmaster? Now at any rate I was free, and I rejoiced. After a while I felt I should like to see what the others were doing. Next moment I was in the dining room. It was so full that, to avoid touching the others, I stood in, or, rather, through the middle of the table. Of course it did not interfere with me in any way, nor, indeed, would their bodies, but yet some instinct, probably inherited from my earthly state, compelled me to avoid running into them. I saw them all, U, G, D, M, and Miss P. There did not seem to be much to learn there, so I drifted into the drawing room, where my wife was, but soon drifted out. To tell the truth, I rather felt as if I was in the way, and wondered vaguely why I had been taken from school, where I was every day learning something new and interesting, to see these vacuities. My guide answered, "At the moment of burial the spirit always feels an inarticulate yearning to see its earthly shell and bid it farewell. There is a good reason for this, indeed, several. Besides the mere earthly attachment which all men feel for their bodies, akin to that usually felt by a dog for its master, even when that master was often cruel to it, there are the following. At burials there are usually certain evil beings who hang round the corpse, hoping against hope, they know not always how, to draw some carnal satisfaction from the corpse, some touch of earthly lusts which still haunt it. Occasionally, under exceptional circumstances, they may try, and even succeed, in drawing a kind of material body from the dead corpse by means of which to clothe their naked souls. This can only happen in the case of men who have lived evil lives. From this shame you are free, nevertheless, you and I go to see that nothing of evil shall approach what once held you. Further, it is right that you should follow to its last resting place a friend with whom you have been associated for so long. Finally, by showing you the pettiness of the life you have left, to make you the more rejoice in that in which you now are." After this I again returned and sat by my corpse, and presently you entered. I saw you remove the napkin and look at my face. But all the time I was standing opposite to you. I saw, rather to my surprise, how distressed you were, and tried to attract your attention, saying, "I am all right. Don't you see me?" Once I thought you heard me, for you looked straight in my face for a moment, but you did not. Then, replacing the napkin and sheet, you turned and left the room. Soon after, the undertaker's men entered, and, having screwed down the lid, took the coffin downstairs. I went with the procession to the church. After the coffin had been lowered into the grave and you had all gone, I did not follow you, but waited by the grave till it was filled in. This completed, I looked at the marble statue which had once held me. I could, of course, see through the earth perfectly well, and then, turning to my guide, said, "Shall we now be going?" The thought had hardly been formed when, lo, I was back in the school again, and oh, with what a sigh of relief. I looked round for my guide, but he had gone, but by now I had become accustomed to his strange comings and goings. "Take your place," said my master kindly. "We have only had one round of questions." Only one round, I thought, yet I was on earth for hours. Indeed, there is no relation between time there and here. My master seemed to divine my thoughts, for he answered at once, "You ought to know by now that here there is no such thing as time." I suppose it was having been back to earth that now made me feel just the least surprised at his answering a thought of mine. I again looked at the boys, and now realized for the first time how small and immature were the mortals whom I had just seen. These, at any rate, were boys, but they, for the most part, were the merest babes, some hardly born. I realized in particular, with mild surprise, how infantile was the spirit in Dash, and in. Yet though both were babes, there was some indescribable difference between them. When I saw you all, I saw your spiritual bodies through a gray sort of shadow, your earthly bodies, and often the largest and finest shadow bodies had the smallest and most misshapen and infantile spirit bodies. How glad I was to be back at school, back in the realities of life. Away from all pettiness and futilities of what you call life on earth, but at the same time a new desire had come upon me, and that was to let you and others know this fact. Rest half an hour. H. J. L. Chapter 12, He Goes to College. H. J. L. S. 10th Letter. Glen House, 8:50 p.m., February 21, 1914. To resume my narrative. After returning to school, I felt strongly that I wanted to tell those I had seen what the real conditions over here were like, partly because I saw one or two were grieving rather, but more because they all either did not believe in a future life at all, or else had evidently wrong ideas as to what it was like over here. I have already told you of my fruitless endeavors to reach other members of the family, and how at length I got in touch with you. Now I will explain how I learnt that one could tell those still living. No sooner had the idea come to me, than my guide entered the classroom. "Your pupil has learnt his lesson so well," he said to our master, "that he can now leave school. He will go to a university instead." "He has made splendid progress," said my master. "Good, go forward, my lad." Class was then dismissed, and all the other boys crowded round me. "You have shot up," they said. "Why, you are nearly a man." Several others, I noticed, were also speaking to their guides, and it was quite a batch of us who said farewell to the building which had now become so familiar to us all. My guide then began to speak. "You wish to communicate with those still living?" "Why?" I said, "to tell them of this life, so that they may try and prepare themselves for it, so that they need not go through the elementary lessons which I had to learn." "Many, too, who believe in a future life have no real idea as to what it is like, but why should you wish to speak to them? They will all come to us someday, and then they will have to learn." "Yes, but on earth I neglected these things, and now would make some little amends." "This is a good reason, and truly they do need much light, and by helping them you will help yourself. Lo! You are now in the second instead of the first stage of this realm or set." "How can I do it?" I said. "That you must find out for yourself. We tell nothing here. Each soul must strive to answer his own questions, and if he really strives he will succeed." Soon I found myself without my guide among a crowd of young men. We seemed to be in some university town. Several of the men drifted towards me, and, without the usual hesitation which I should have felt on earth, I asked what I could do to tell those on earth of this life. One of them replied, "We, too, are trying to find out how to do the very thing. Come with us." We now searched throughout that large town, and at last found what we sought. Let me say here that the dominant note of the place was the desire to help others who were already dead. At length we found a lecturer, as he would have been called on earth. But he did not lecture, but asked us questions, as the master had done. When we said, "How can we tell those still living?" he replied, "How do you do anything here?" "By thinking about it." "You are answered." "We think then," I said, "that we wish to communicate with the living." "Naturally, how otherwise?" "And do we think of one person or many?" "Which you please, but which is easier, to think of one person or many persons?" "One," we all cried together. "Are there any other questions?" he asked. We had none then, so we went together to a sort of private study and there all concentrated our thoughts on this great matter. It sounds very simple to say think of something, but in practice we found it terribly hard to concentrate on one sole thought. Other ideas would come floating in. We seemed to try this for weeks and weeks, but at length one man did get through. This encouraged us. Another who had been trying for some time said, "I wonder if the man I am thinking about is not receptive." This started a long discussion, and we all agreed that probably it would be easier to get in touch with those who were not too materialistic. So, as we could not always tell who were the most materialistic, we decided to make such a list, and work through them by degrees. You know the rest. At length I got you. That night I seemed specially drawn towards earth, I think now because it was just a week since I had died. I gradually became aware of the fact that I was drawing closer to you than I had yet done to the others, but it was not till you went to bed that I really got in touch with you. This taught me how to work, and, once started, things went easier. Finally, I met P, who told me how to try automatic writing. Yours, H. J. L. Chapter 13, Animals on the Spirit Plane. Transvisional conversation during night of February 23rd. I, J. W., found myself seated by the edge of a beautiful lake. It reminded me at one time of Coniston, but next moment it seemed more like Lake Lucerne. H. J. L. was by me. Do you, I said, have houses to live in? Yes, he replied. I at present am living in college. Is it like any college which still exists? I think, he replied, that it is Old Queen's College, Oxford, which was pulled down to make way for the present classical building. J. W. Did you know of the Requiem Mass which my father held for you on the day of the funeral? H. J. L. Yes, but I did not know that it was on the same day. I knew of it what appeared to be some time before. That service was of far more use to me than the funeral service. It is strange that so many Christians devote all their attention to the body, which knows and cares nothing about what is going on, and entirely neglect the spirit, which is often in great need of help. I was going through one of those terrible days, of course they are not days, but I know no other name to give them for you, when my former deeds crowded upon me on every side. These days come on me even still, they are part of my punishment, and are sent to enable me to repent. I, of course, could not go to school, and was there overwhelmed with misery, when, lo, a bright flame seemed to force its way through my nightmare visions and dissolve them. Slowly in their place there came a vision of a church with an altar on which were candles and a cross, and before it was a priest. I recognized him as your father and, further, saw you kneeling there, but though you two were the only mortals, you were not alone. Who they were who knelt beside you I cannot say, but certainly the whole church, not merely the side chapel, was full of worshippers who had come from our side. No words of mine can express the joy that this sight filled me with. Firstly, I rejoiced that there were at least some on earth who really cared and believed enough to pray for me, and the thought and the words of the service filled me with a wonderful peace. But even beyond this came the inspiring thought that hundreds of others who had come here before, had possibly trodden the same hard road as I was treading, were interested in my progress and prayed for me. Oh Jack, I never knew how much good might be hidden in that wonderful contradictory old national church of ours. Tennyson must have received some inspiration from this side when he retained in his Morte d'Arthur those closing lines of Malory, clean contradictory as they must have been to the ideas of the mid-Victorians, pray for my soul. You know the rest, don't you? J. W. Yes, well. By the by, as animals come here, have you seen anything of old Molly? Carrie's dog. H. J. L. Oh yes. She often comes to me. As there is no one else here she knows, I think, there she is. J. W. Where? I can't see her. H. J. L. Here she comes. As he spoke, Molly came rushing out of a small wood close by. She looked somewhat younger than when she died and had quite lost her hump, but otherwise there seemed no change. She jumped and gaped about, first round H. J. L. and then round me, wagging her tail and barking with excitement. I made her walk on her hind legs as she used to do. Presently she curled up beside H. J. L. If animals survive in this state, I asked, what becomes of them when the frontier of this plane is reached? Do they, too, go on to the fifth plane? H. J. L. That is one of the points we are investigating. I have particularly asked P. to inquire in his division. This leads me to try and fix the terms I use for our divisions here. I am afraid they have been a little incoherent. I will therefore use henceforth, plane equals the whole of this realm of the spiritual body. Realm equals the divisions of this plane, for example the realm of half-belief. Division equals the divisions of each realm, for example the schools or the divisions of hell. Subdivisions equals the splitting up of the divisions as among the sects in the realm of belief without acts, for example the Roman Catholics or Baptists. Spheres equals the groups into which we drift during the times we are having recreation. They bring together men in different divisions of the same realm, but not those who are in different realms. Moreover, a man will sometimes be in one sphere and sometimes in another, for example the sphere of architecture or music. Now, as to next Saturday's work, P. is very anxious to start writing, so I shall let him. He will give an account of his passing on to the realm above. Strictly, I ought to write first an account of the entrance of the officer into our realm as seen by me. It occurred first, and also what I know of P.S. passing, but I will do so after he has written. I will, however, tell you how I met P. I had been inquiring about the realm below and that above, and suddenly a man came to me and said, I have been down to hell on a little missionary work, so perhaps I can give you some information. I was delighted. He told me about the divisions of hell, and that he had been sent to teach the souls in the schools. He was not allowed to go any lower, but even that had retarded his progress. He hoped, however, soon to be allowed to pass on to the realm above us. He said, further, that the souls in hell were terribly hard to teach, far harder than the worst types of people on earth, and this in spite of the fact that none had reached the seventh division unless they desired to progress. If you really wish to know about the depths of hell, I know the man who can tell you, P. added. He was an army officer, and I have been teaching him for some time. He will soon be admitted into this realm, and I will introduce him to you and ask him to help you. I was privileged to help him and feel sure he will do what I wish in the matter. He is a man with a tremendous personality, and made good progress. You may still think him a fairly unregenerate blackguard, but I assure you he is enormously improved. When he first came to me, he was by far the worst in the whole school, and I often wondered why he had been admitted, but he rapidly passed all the others other schools like ours in hell. I said, H. J. L. They are almost impossible to compare, P. replied. The nearest simile which occurs to me is, as a school for mentally afflicted children is to a first-class secondary school on earth. Even that does not show the full difference. The schools for the babies, which I never entered, correspond fairly closely to the kindergartens on earth, though of course different subjects are taught. Many other things P. described to me, and I have given you them from time to time. But I was not long to have the advantage of his company, for soon after the passing up to us of the officer, P.S. guide took him away for his final preparations for his own passing on. Before going, he obtained from his guide a promise that he might on occasion return to us, as he had gone down into hell, to bring us the news we desired. Now I have given you enough. Consider me at the university with other students working at this subject which I have chosen, the subject being to discover all I can about the conditions of life here in all the realms, and to transmit this knowledge to you. Consider me surrounded by many fellow students all working at the same problem, further, as having recreations and amusements approximating to those which are the highest on earth. All these mental amusements are carried on a far higher plane. There are also recreations of which you know nothing on earth. Now goodbye for the time being, Jack. Think of me and pray for help for me. See, I can fly now. He rose in the air and floated away across the lake, and I stood watching the rosy light of the oversetting sun tinging the waters of the lake. Then I knew no more. J. W. Chapter 14, Little Blanche Sees H. J. L. Blanche Sees H. J. L. February 26th. C. W. and Blanche were in the drawing room at 7 p.m., and B. wandered up to the window and looked out at the sky from the darkened room. The sky was covered with stars. She exclaimed, I see the big granddad crossing the sky. He's got a candle or torch in his hand with a star for the light. He keeps moving backwards and forwards. Now he has gone into a room and is learning something. He has a book. Immediately after she said, I can see him coming along again. A little girl is following him, like Betty, a six-year-old cousin, only she has reddish hair. 7. She has a doll in her hand. Now he's talking to her and holding her hand. Earlier she said, he pulled me, I felt him. Sometime later, about 7:45, C. W. And she went out in the garden to see the stars. She then said, there is the big granddad. He has picked a bunch of stars. They are flowers to him, he's putting them in a vase. A correct summary. C. W. Chapter 15, How H. J. L. met the officer. Transvision and Conversation, March 2, 1914. During these I seemed to be transferred to another country or plane of existence. I found myself seated by the side of the river, and beside me was H. J. L.